Yes. I did comment on that whenever it was. Last class. I'm not looking for a major paper of any sort. My intent is get you to reflect on the structure of Deuteronomy. So it's really sort of an outline. A couple pages. Doesn't have to be typewritten. That's a general idea. Okay? Yes?
Are we responsible for the
Yes. Yes. As far as the final exam, the emphasis of the final exam will be on lecture material from the midterm till wherever we are at the end of next week. I may ask a few questions from the first part of the course, but not much. The emphasis will be lecture from the midterm on. I won't ask anything from reading from the first part, but I may ask you a few questions from some reading I have not quizzed from the second half of the course.
And then the next week's reading.
You mean for next week?
Yeah.
Yeah. That will be responsible for that. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Do any of you notice anyone who isn't here? I guess I can get that from the attendance sheet. As far as Monday, I don't want somebody coming in a long ways.
George Tucker.
All right, I'll have to call him, I guess, make sure he knows that. Okay. All right, we were discussing Genesis chapter 22, which is C under Abraham as our spiritual father, the high point of Abraham's faith. I had begun discussing that at the end of last hour. Let's go back and pick up on that. In verse 2, Abraham is told to sacrifice Isaac, his son, with his own hand. Now, the background for that command is that he is really told to sacrifice the son through whom the promise was to be realized. Abraham at this point did have another son, Ishmael, through Hagar. But the promise was to be fulfilled through Isaac, not through Ishmael. So if you go back and look at chapter 21, verse 12, you read, God said unto Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad and because of thy bondwoman. And all that Sarah hath said to thee, hearken unto her voice, in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Verse 13 says, of the son of the bondwoman, I will also make a nation because he is thy seed. But this promised line of the seed is to come through Isaac. And if you go back a little bit further to Genesis 17, verse 18, you read that Abraham said unto God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. And God said, Sarah thy wife shall bear thee a son, indeed. Thou shalt call his name Isaac. And here's the important statement. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard thee, I have blessed him, will make him fruitful, will multiply him, will make him a great nation. Verse 21. But my covenant will I establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time in the next year. So in 17, 18 through 20, and actually through 21, you have it explicit that this line is to continue through Isaac. And you see, that's why in the last class hour when I read Calvin's comments on Genesis 22, he says the conflict in Abraham was between the word of the Lord, in connection with that promise, and what he was telling him to do at this point. And it was a test of Abraham's faith, which he was able to sustain. I think the theme of the chapter, Genesis 22, is the phrase, God will provide. You find that in verse 8, where Isaac in verse 7 has said, behold the fire and the wood, where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abram said, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went both of them together. And then in verse 14, after Abraham was ready to slay his son, and the Lord prevents him and says, and he sees the ram in the thicket and takes him and offers him for a burnt offering instead. You read in verse 14, Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh. Now, I'm reading from the King James translation. If you translate that, Jehovah Jireh, which here is just transliterated from the Hebrew, it's that same expression, the Lord will provide. And then, the last phrase of the verse, as it is said today, the King James translation, again, I think obscures this, because it says, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. If you're consistent in your translation, you'll translate that last phrase again, in the mountain the Lord will provide. Because the word that is translated provide all the way through here is a passive form of the Hebrew verb to see, ra'ah. So, you know, you could literally go back to verse 8. Let me look in the NIV here. Well, it says, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering. If you translate it literally, God will see to a lamb for a burnt offering, or something of that sort. It's a verb to see, in a passive form of see. Provides a good translation of it. But then you should be consistent, you see, all the way through. The NIV has it 14, I think much better than the King James. The NIV says, so Abraham called the place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. So I think that is the primary thought that is being emphasized in the narrative in Genesis chapter 22. The Lord will provide. And the Lord provided the ram. And of course, ultimately, the Lord provided his own son as a sacrifice for sin. Yeah.
How does the King James put the second part of verse
14? King James says, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. Shall be seen. See, it takes that ra'ah from see. Which I think obscures, you see, the emphasis on that phrase in the chapter. Now, verse 12, when Abraham has been obedient, verse 12 says, in the middle of the verse, that God says, for now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. For now I know. We could say, didn't God know before Abraham's faith? Certainly in his omniscience, he knew the strength of Abraham's faith. And certainly God was at work to strengthen him to meet this challenge. I think you're best to understand an expression like that as an anthropomorphic expression. That's the technical term that's often used when things of this sort that are very human are attributed to God. The main point of the test is really for Abraham himself, to demonstrate to him and to us the faithfulness of God to his covenant promises. Okay, any questions or comments on chapter 22? Yeah.
I can't remember which commentator it was, but he was drawing a parallel between pagan sacrifices of his children and the nature of this test being a sacrifice of his son. The intent of the passage was that God was calling upon Abraham to make a supreme sacrifice, and though saying to him that the pagans were willing to sacrifice their children, would he be willing to sacrifice his only son? What do you make of that kind of comparison, which takes into account the culture of his people?
Well, it's a difficult question. Of course, elsewhere in the Old Testament, you have strong condemnation of human sacrifice. Which, of course, here then raises the difficult question to a certain extent. In this book, Walter Kaiser, Toward an Old Testament Ethic, page 262, he says, Genesis 22 has been represented as a divine command to commit murder in its most horrible form, and therefore is totally out of character with the holiness of God. The next paragraph, he discusses that a bit further. He says, the law clearly prohibited human sacrifice, spoke scornfully of those who ordered their sons to be offered to Molech. But, he says, Genesis 22 does not encourage such, for the narrator is exceedingly careful to introduce his account as a test. True, this notation was meant to help the reader, not Abraham, for in his case it had to be a genuine trial, and so he was not informed about it. But an event must be judged by its wholeness, not just by its introductory command. So he makes that distinction, and then emphasizes in his own discussion that the thing that's highlighted in this is God's mercy and grace in providing. He says, if it be objected, what kind of a God would subject man to this type of ordeal? The answer will depend on which part of the narrative is emphasized. If the initial command to sacrifice Isaac is stressed, then the resulting image of God will be one of deception. But if the intervention of Yahweh to stay his raised hand and his subsequent blessing of Abraham is stressed, then one's conclusion will agree with Roland DeVos, who says, any Israelite who heard this story would take it to mean that his race owed its existence to the mercy of God and its prosperity to the obedience of their ancestors. In other words, what he says, shouldn't really focus on the command so much to slay the son as focus on the mercy of God in providing a substitute. Now, I'm not sure that solves the problem. Certainly, I don't think you can say, well, Kaiser goes further. It brings a very difficult question up. Kaiser says, Gerhardus Voss surprises us with the estimate that the divine command to sacrifice Isaac, quote, distinctly implies in the abstract the sacrifice of a human being cannot be condoned on principle. It is well to be cautious in committing oneself to that critical opinion, for it strikes at the very root of the atonement. That's Voss's statement. Kaiser's statement is, Voss's point is that Abraham is asked by God to offer life, the life dearest to him, his only son. But with the last minute intervention of the angel, a substitute of one life, in this case a ram's life, for another, is announced as acceptable to God. Therefore, Voss concludes, quote, not sacrifice of human life as such, but the sacrifice of average sinful human life is deprecated by the Old Testament, end of quote. Now, Kaiser at that point says, I hardly know what to make of Voss's line of reason. How could any human life known to man after the fall function as a gift, much less a substitute, to God? I have no biblical qualms about the principle of substitution, for that's germane to the text itself, but I cannot agree that Isaac, as human life, functions here to point theoretically or even principially to a blood atonement. He rejects that analogy, which Voss seems to be pushing. The emphasis of the passage falls on the test aspect and the grace and mercy of God in maintaining his promise, unaided by any conniving assistance from some of the promise's first recipients. If you're going to say in principle what's being addressed here is the idea of a human sacrifice of a life as an atonement, Kaiser objects to that because he says no human life actually could do that. And he would prefer simply to look at this as emphasizing the test aspect, the grace and mercy of God in providing an alternative. So, I don't know how much you want to dwell on the parallel between human sacrifice, which did exist among those cultures, and what God tells Abraham to do here. Because certainly the weight of the Old Testament is against any legitimacy to human sacrifice.
I'm not sure whether it was you who said this, but the emphasis of this event seems to be in its anti-type in the sacrifice of Golgotha. And that would not be a clear parallel if in the mind of Abraham he was not to kill Isaac.
Now, what I said there as far as the parallel with Golgotha was the passing that smoking furnace between the slain halves of the animals in Genesis chapter 15. Now here, I think the parallel, if you're going to draw the parallel more, is like with the New Testament text, he that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all. God was willing to spare his son in order to provide for our salvation. Abraham here was willing to spare his son to be obedient to God. It seems to me that there is a line of parallel.
So that in Abraham's mind, it must very clearly have been the fact that he wants to kill his son, if the parallel is going to be established.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the Hebrews passage throws light on that. He felt he had total confidence in God. God had given the promise that his promised line was going to continue through Isaac. Therefore, when the Lord says, take his life, Abraham was convinced, if necessary, God would raise him from the dead. So he took God at his word, did not doubt his promise, and was obedient. Now, I think that's the thing to focus on. When you get into the question of how could God command Abraham to take the life of his own son, that's hard. Very, very hard. See, what Kaiser tries to do is back off that and say it really wasn't God's intent ever for him to do that. The focus should be on the mercy and the grace and the provision, and it was a test. It's hard. I don't know if that's the best answer. Yeah.
If God said that God couldn't, because it would be unjust or wrong for God to actually have Abraham go through the killing of Isaac, it's not really mercy.
He could have done it, and God could have, as Hebrews said, raised him from the dead, so that his promise would have been not voided. You get into these hypothetical things, and it's hard. All right, let's go on to 3. Abraham's lapses, failures, weaknesses. Certainly Abraham was a great man. You see the greatness of his faith in chapter 22. But he was not a perfect man. And the Bible shows us weak points as well as strong points, not only with Abraham, but with other prominent figures in the Old Testament. So he's a hero of faith. He is represented as such, particularly in the New Testament, Romans, Hebrews, James. But he's still a sinful man. What is primary in his life is the grace of God, not his own goodness. And he has weaknesses, but God overrules and works in spite of those weaknesses. So A under 3 is Genesis 12 and Genesis 20. Abraham represents his wife as his sister, as an expedient to help himself. So let's look at Genesis 12 and then Genesis 20. In Genesis 12, because of a famine, this is shortly after he comes into the land of Canaan, he goes down to Egypt to seek food. You read in verse 10, there was a famine in the land. He went into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous. And it came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, he said to Sarai his wife, behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. Therefore it shall come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they shall say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive. Alive. Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee. He fears that his wife's beauty will lead to an attempt on the part of the Egyptians to get rid of himself, because he's her husband. And he calculates that if he says she is his sister, perhaps that will lead to the opposite, and he will be given favors and good treatment. Now, that's the tactic. It seems to have been something that was agreed upon by Abraham and Sarah, and perhaps used in other instances, because, you know, they did a lot of travel and a lot of movement. If you look at chapter 20, verse 13, which is in the context of the second incident of this with Abimelech of Gerar, you find in verse 13, it came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said unto her, this is thy kindness which thou shalt show to me at every place to which we shall come. Say of me, he is my brother. Now, that's a half-truth. It's not a total falsehood. Because if you go back up to verse 11, Abraham said, this is in chapter 20, verse 11. Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. And yet, indeed, she is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. So she was really his half-sister, who became his wife. So when they say to someone, which apparently they did in numerous places, that Sarah was his sister, that was true. But it certainly was a deception, because she was also his wife, and only his half-sister. Now, some question... question was raised here the other day. How Sarah could have been so attractive at age 65 or 90. You get the ages by looking at 12:4. You read when Abraham left Haran, he was 75 years old. You compare that with 17:17. You read there that Abraham says, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old, and shall Sarah that is 90 years old bear? You find there that there's a 10-year difference in age between Abraham and Sarah. So that means when Abraham left Haran to come down into Canaan, he was 75, as we know in chapter 12. That means that Sarah in chapter 12 was 65, or approximately 65. If you go further, in 21:5, you read, Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. Now, Isaac was born just shortly, you see, chapter 20 is that Abimelech story, the second time. So, if Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born, Sarah was about 90 years old on that second incident. You read in 23:1 that she lived to be 120 years old, 127 years old. Yeah. Sarah was 107 and 20 years old. These were the years of the life of Sarah, and Sarah died. So she lived to be an age of 127. Now, a comment on this question with respect to her beauty or age. I think you can ask the question, what was the average age of menopause when people were living to be 125? Today it's 45 to 50 years old. If the average lifespan is now about 50 years less, perhaps menopause also was about 50 years less, or about 75. I'm just, it's pure speculation. But it seems to me you could speculate that menopause, when people were living so much longer, may have been, instead of 45 to 50, may have been about 75. And if it was 75, for her at age 65 or 90 to still have a great deal of beauty is certainly not unreasonable, I don't think. Now, of course, the average age today, I guess many of you saw the news maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, of Florence Knapp, oldest woman in the world, who died about 3 weeks ago at age 114. She was a resident in the Doc Terrace Nursing Home here in Lansdale. My wife was caring for her for the last couple of years. But it's a remarkable thing. I mean, somebody who lived 114 years old. We think we're way off. What was Sarah lived 127. That's not a whole lot more. In any case, Sarah's beauty leads them to take this approach to try to avoid problems for Abraham. And what happened is that Sarah was taken into the harem of Pharaoh. And exactly as Abraham suspected, he received all sorts of gifts. You read that in verse 14 of chapter 12. Came to pass when Abram was coming to Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. And the princes of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And then verse 16, he treated Abraham well for her sake. He had sheep and oxen, he asses, men servants, maid servants, she asses, and camels. But the result is, you said, she is my sister. And verse 19 says, so I might have taken her to me as my wife. Now therefore, behold thy wife, take her and go thy way. And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him. They sent him away and his wife and all that he had. Now, what are we to make of this story? Why is the story included? It seems to me that the point is, we see God's grace and preservation of Abraham and Sarah in spite of their human sin. God intervenes in the midst of this impossible situation, which is brought about by this tactic of Abraham and Sarah. And it seems to me the significant thing is related to the promised line of the seed. God protects Abraham and Sarah so that they will yet be the bearers of the promised seed. And even though they get themselves into that predicament, the Lord delivers and keeps that marriage intact through whom the promised seed will come. In Joseph Free's book on archaeology and Bible history, page 55, he has a few comments on this passage. He says, a possible reason for Abraham saying Sarah was his sister rather than his wife is furnished by the discovery of a papyrus document which tells that Pharaoh had a beautiful woman brought to his court and caused her husband to be murdered. One can see why Abraham wished it to be understood that he was the brother of Sarah rather than her husband. In other words, his fear may have been legitimate, but it certainly doesn't justify the deceitfulness. The other thing he notices, or makes a note of, is that the casual reader usually takes no particular notice of the indication that Abraham had camels among his possessions in Egypt. You see in verse 16, it says, he had sheep, oxen, he has his men servants, maid servants, she has his camels. I think I mentioned earlier, that's a point that Bible critics have often brought up as being anachronistic again. They say camels were not domesticated until after this time, so this can't be reliable at this point. Free's comment is that there is archaeological evidence showing early knowledge of the camel in Egypt, including statuettes, figurines of camels, plaques bearing representations of camels, rock carvings and drawings, camel bones, camel skull, camel hair rope. These objects, some 20 in number, range from the 7th century BC to the period before 3000 BC. So you get again into this argument of interpretation of archaeological data. And according to Free, there is good evidence that camels were domesticated long before the time of David. All right, secondly, the passage in chapter 20, where this same tactic is used the second time. In chapter 20, you read in verse 1 that Abraham journeys toward the Negev to Gerar, and Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister," and Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, thou art but a dead man. For the woman whom thou hast taken, for she is a man's wife." But Abimelech had not come near her. He said, "Lord, wilt thou slay a righteous nation?" Said he not unto me, "She is my sister"? And she, even she herself, said, "He is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this." And the result is that Sarah is released again. Now, I think to understand chapter 20, it's very important that we look at the context of chapter 20 and notice the background to what happens in chapter 20. If you go back to 17, you read in 17:17, Abraham fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, "Shall a child be born unto him that's 100 years old? And shall Sarah that is 90 years old bear?" And Abram said unto God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." And God said, "Sarah thy wife shall bear thee a son indeed. Thou shalt call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant with his seed after him." Down to verse 21, "My covenant will I establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time in the next year." So you see, in 17:17, it's told Abraham and Sarah that at this set time, in the next year, Isaac's going to be born. Now, read, look also chapter 18, verse 10 and 14. You have two other statements. He said, "I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life. And lo, Sarah, thy wife, shall have a son." According to the time of life. And then down in verse 14, after Sarah laughs, verse 14, "Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the time appointed, I will return to thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son." So you have in chapter 17, this set time in the next year, according to the time of life in 18:10, at the appointed time in 18:14, and according to the time of life again in 18:14. Now the interesting thing is, those phrases occur in 1 Kings, or 2 Kings, chapter 4, almost the identical phrases. If you, this is the Hebrew of what's translated this set time in Genesis 17:21. And the Hebrew of 18:14 at the time appointed, and the Hebrew of 18:10 and 18:14 according to the time of life. Now, if you look at 2 Kings 4, Second Kings 4:16, you read, he said about this season, "When the time cometh, thou shalt embrace a son." And she said, "Nay, my Lord, thou man of God, do not lie unto thine handmaid." And the woman conceived and bore a son at that season that Elisha had said unto her, according to the set time. Now, the context of those statements are Elisha's promise to the Shunammite woman that she would have a child, a son. It's identical expressions in the Hebrew. In 2 Kings 4:17, at that season, it's the same Hebrew expression as at this set time. The about this season is also that expression. It's just translated in two different ways. And then, according to the time of life, is translated when the time cometh, and according to the set time. But it's the same phrase in the Hebrew as it is in 18:10-14. Now, it seems quite clear that what Abraham and Sarah are told is that within a year they're going to have a son. And it may even be shorter than that. In other words, the set time, according to the time of life, what is the time of life? Is the time of life a year, or is that the term of pregnancy, 9 months? It may be the latter. So it may be that Abraham and Sarah were to conceive almost immediately, and that according to the time of life, at this time, in the next year, you're going to have a son. Now you see, that's all background to Abraham going down to Gerar in chapter 20. And he goes down to Gerar, and he tells Abimelech, she's my sister. And Abimelech takes Sarah into his harem. And then the Lord comes to Abimelech and says, you're but a dead man. For the woman whom thou hast taken, she is a man's wife. So I think what we see is that God in his grace preserved Sarah as the mother of the promised seed. And God's intervention prevents any suspicion or doubt arising concerning who fathered the child to be born. That certainly is not Abraham's doing. But God is working out his purposes in and through Abraham, in spite of his weaknesses, and protecting that promised line. You notice what follows chapter 20 in the book of Genesis. Go to the first verse of chapter 21, right after the Abimelech of Gerar incident, verse 20, or verse 1 of chapter 21, the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. So you see, this Abimelech thing happens between the point of the promise of that and the realization of it. And so it seems to me that its significance, again, is in relation to this preservation of the promised seed through Abraham and Sarah. Okay. Secondly, under Abraham's lapses, which is B on your outline sheet, Abraham and Hagar. Genesis chapter 16. Now this backs up a bit. Abraham had been promised a seed. And that was way back in 12. In 15, it's repeated. In 15:4, you read, Eliezer shall not be your heir, but he that comes forth out of thine own loins shall be your heir. But Sarah remains barren. And you get to chapter 16, and you read in the first verse, Sarah, Abram's wife, bore him no children. And Sarah says to Abraham, verse 2, Behold now the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, maybe a maid she had received when they were there in Egypt. It's quite possible she was an Egyptian. After Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So it had been 10 years. The promise hadn't been fulfilled. And so he takes Hagar, and a son is born to Abraham through Hagar. Abraham and Sarah look for a different way of fulfilling the promise. And they try to arrange by this means for Abraham to have a son. Now, that sort of arrangement sounds rather strange to us. But it was not something uncommon in that time. There are references to this kind of an arrangement in Hammurabi's Law Code, in the Nuzi text, other ancient texts of that sort. I brought these two volumes. I don't know if you've ever seen them. It's on your bibliography, but I don't think there's anything other than the title on your bibliography. I guess it's on that sheet I just handed out, which I didn't keep a copy for myself or me. Here it is. Yeah, page 14, about the fourth entry. Fourth entry. Chronicles News of the Past. I think there are three volumes. I have two volumes of this. It is an Old Testament history, or a history of the Jews would be a better way to put it, in newspaper format. So that, let me just show you some of these. This is Abraham and the New Faith, is the big story. Exchange of letters between Abram and Melchizedek. Sodom and Gomorrah wiped out in worst disaster since the flood. Mysterious blaze quakes sweeps valley of Siddim. And then you see you have foreign news. Hyksos take Egyptian capital. That's what's going on in Egypt. The Hyksos are in Egypt. Here, Larsa falls to Hammurabi. Dating of that, you see Hammurabi's about 1700. Abraham's dating's not entirely accurate. It's approximate. Generally, this is quite good historically. Jacob protests son's arrest, spy hunt in Egypt. Accused denied charge of espionage, came to buy food, quote, for starving family. And here you have Joseph is dead. Will the Hebrews leave Egypt? Thutmose III smashes enemy at Megiddo. That's probably with the Hittites. Another thing you have in here that you really ought to look at this because there are a lot of very humorous things. There are a lot of ads. Every page has advertising. Here is we deeply mourn the loss of our dear father, brother, and uncle Joseph. He passed away a month ago. And 10 days ago, the bereaved family. Over here is, now you too can have your body or the body of a loved one embalmed. If your means are limited, ask for our plan one. Removal of internal organs, 2-week salt and soda bath, single layer of linen bandages. You may want the added services of plan two. Cedar oil injected for a slow and inoffensive dissolution of the internal organs, 3-week brine bath, double layer of bandages, copy of Book of the Dead. For the man of distinction, there's our 40-day deluxe method, plan three. I want to read all that. But that's all through, these advertisements are all through this. There's copies of this in the library if you want to look at them sometime. But the reason I mentioned this, in the, I think the third one of these, yeah, there's an article, Sarah versus Hagar. Court rules, Hagar stays, affirms Ishmael's rights. And then in a box, excerpts from the Law of Hammurabi bearing on the Sarah Hagar case. And the quote there from Hammurabi's code says, if a man married a woman and she did not provide him with children, and he has decided to marry again, that man may marry a second wife, bringing her into his house, but with that second wife ranking in no way with the first. If a man married a woman and she gave him a female slave, so here's the situation in Genesis 16, who then bore children. If later that female slave has claimed equality with her mistress because she, the slave, bore children, her mistress may not sell her. She may, however, mark her with the slave mark and count her among her slaves. If she did not bear children, her mistress may sell her. If a man's first wife bore him children, and his female slave also bore him children, if the father has ever said, "My children," to the children whom the slave bore him, thus having counted them with the children of the first wife, then after the father has gone to his fate, the children of the first wife and the children of the slave shall share equally in the goods of the paternal estate, the firstborn of the first wife receiving a preferential share. I read that just to show that the practice of taking a slave was something that was known in the time of Hammurabi and regulated by law. Okay, we're a bit over time. I'll stop at this point.